You're listening to the podcast of the musictherapyresearchblog.com. This episode of the Music Therapy Research Podcast is a little bit different, although it's still technically part of our series interviewing members of the editorial board of the Journal of Music Therapy. This one has Dr. Deborah Burns, Caitlin Crater, and Dr. Sherry Robb, who is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Music Therapy. And they thought it would be interesting for the five of us actually on this podcast to get together and actually talk a little bit about their research project, some larger scale research projects. But we also wanted to make sure that we got in touch with the, what I would say is the more teamwork aspect. Maybe I'll say that is the teamwork aspect of research. How Caitlin came along as a clinician to be part of the study, and how Dr. Burns, who's been on the podcast before, and Dr. Robb, who's been on the podcast before, how both Deb and Sherry approach research in their different ways, and how they got into it. And we really think it turned out to be a great discussion, and hope you do as well. Dr. Sherry Robb, like I mentioned, is editor of the Journal of Music Therapy. You can read the rest of her bio on musictherapyresearchblog.com. Dr. Deborah Burns is at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis. And you can see a little bit also about Caitlin's bio as well. And I've known all of them for quite a while now. And Caitlin, as a matter of fact, I started to know her maybe 5 or 6 years ago as I was as she was a student officer for the Midwestern region, and I was the regional student affairs advisory board professional representative from the Midwestern region. So I sort of advised the group of officers that included Caitlin. And so it was really nice just to reconnect with all of them and talk research for this particular podcast on the Music Therapy Research Blog. Hope you enjoy. So thanks again for joining us. And the first question that we talk to our guests in this particular series that we're putting together is about a pathway to becoming interested in music therapy research. And we've had both Deb Burns and Sherry Robb on before. And so the new addition to this conversation is you, Caitlin. And I'm wondering if you would talk about how you got interested, or at least mixed up with these two leaders in music therapy research for us.
Yeah, happy to talk about that. I finished my undergraduate degree and was doing my internship at Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis, and was approached by Sherry to be an interventionist on her SMART study, and really had never thought of myself as getting into research or smart enough or capable enough to really get involved until that experience kind of dipped my toe in the water. And I am forever grateful, because that has really snowballed into a great passion, and have gotten some great opportunities just by starting out very small. I would definitely say that was the impetus of this great journey.
That sounds like a great way to learn from learning from experienced researchers. Can you tell us a little bit more about the SMART study?
Yes. So when I was first introduced to the SMART study, it was actually SMART 2. So they had already gone through this therapeutic music video protocol, and they were doing the second round, where every participant was able to participate in the music therapy portion, and then the nurse intervention portion was what was going to be looked at this time. And Sherry and Deb can definitely speak much more eloquently about it than I. So I was able to really learn from everyone on the team, including music therapists, nurse interventionists. And that was also a great experience to be able to not only immerse yourself in music therapy research, but understand the importance of collaboration as well.
And Sherry and Deb in particular, and maybe Sherry first and then Deb, you can talk about your role, but can you, because you're both in different roles. I mean, everybody here is a board certified music therapist, but Deb and Sherry, you have different roles in your primary jobs. And so how did you come to sort of concoct the basics of the SMART study?
Well, I have to give that credit to Deb because Deb was already at IUPUI doing her postdoctoral fellowship, and she happened to be in a lecture being given by Joan Hossie, who had just come to the university in an endowed professorship. And so Joan was talking about her resilience and illness model, which is a theoretical framework for how, what are the risk and protective factors that contribute to adolescents being able to be resilient in the face of a cancer diagnosis and treatment. And she, I'm pretty sure, Deb, she had said that she was now ready to take her model forward and test an intervention.
Yeah, that's what happened.
And Deb was familiar with some pilot work that we had been doing at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics with songwriting and digital video production. And so in the true form that Deb is the great connector, she went up to Joan and said, you need to meet my friend Sherry Robb because she's doing some work that fits very well with the research that you're doing. And that brought the three of us together. And Deb was responsible for spearheading that and then doing the initial pilot studying on Joan's model combined with the intervention that then led to the our first NIH grant.
Right. So in the current studies too, you know, so I'm over in music and arts technology, and I want to back up just a little bit to Caitlin's involvement in research too, since she was an intervener in SMART too, from her clinical experience delivering the intervention, the music video intervention, she was noticing some things. And from our, the results from our first study, SMART One, that's published in Cancer, we noticed that all the kids were getting through the protocol and regardless of how sick they were. So Caitlin, as part of her graduate studies here and her thesis project, is looking at some of the ways the interventionists, the music therapists, are working within the protocol to tailor the intervention to make sure that the patients are all successful in finishing it and saying what they need to say in the music video. So that's just another example of how we get music therapists, clinicians involved in research and exploring different ways to change their practice or improve their practice and how they work within theory. So, and so that's been a really interesting sort of learning experience, I think, for all of us to look at intervention protocols in a different way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so back to the SMART trials, you know, we were able to get some internal funding from, it's called an Institutional American Cancer Society grant that they award to the Cancer Center, and then the Cancer Center distributes out pilot funding to test Sherry's intervention that she had developed in Kansas City and merge that with the model. And that's turned out pretty nice. And then the current study is looking at the how nurses can support the family as the adolescents and young adults are going through the music video production.
That's all really interesting. And thank you for talking about what was happening and what is happening within those studies. I have a question for Caitlin. As an interventionist, you said at the beginning that you weren't sure that this was something that you could do, and then you were all of a sudden involved in research. For some of our listeners who might be interested in doing research, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like being an interventionist? Is that similar to or different from being a clinician?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question because that is kind of a little bit of what I was looking at throughout the thesis project as well, is how were the therapists able to use their best clinical judgment to kind of modify certain aspects of this standardized protocol to best meet the patient need. So when you're working within an intervention, it sounds rigid. It looks very black and white, but I found that you are still using your best clinical judgment in the situation to really meet the individual patient's needs. So you might be leveling choices or providing a little bit more of a restrictive environment, and to really help them to achieve to the best of their ability within this standardized protocol. So although it is a protocol, there's still a lot of room for you to do what you do as a music therapist. And that was really fun to kind of get inside and have be able to look through all of these transcripts of therapy sessions, and to go through and get to kind of look inside the inner workings of a music therapist and see what they were doing to modify the protocol.
Thanks for that, Caitlin. I'm wondering also if we could talk a little bit about the other side, the part about research where you get to tell everybody about all the neat things that you found out too. So the publication side of things, and maybe just to start with you, Deb, in terms of the publications that you've been lead author on that were either part of the study or part of sort of the nexus or the surrounding areas of the study, things that you'd like to highlight for listeners if they would like to check out some of your writing on the topic. What would you direct them to, and how might you summarize how the publications came about? And then Sherry, if you could talk about yours as well.
Within the SMART in particular, or just overall?
Well, you know, it seemed to me, if I'm just looking at your citations and I'm putting together my Deb Burns only literature review, that I'm finding, you know, that I'm seeing that you've got sort of a constellation of research around this different area of, you know, this cancer, and then there's the cancer nursing specific ones, and then there's the SMART stuff with kids, and then there's breast cancer survivors, and maybe talk about how you sort of assembled, how this whole constellation of your publications came together, if you wanted to highlight a couple of them within that constellation.
Sure. Okay. So, you know, given my inquisitive nature, I get excited about a lot of things. So if one thing's a big challenge for me, it's saying no to people, because the other, you know, one of my main requirements for working with people is that we have a good time, because I like to have a good time and get a lot done, and that seems to be a good combination. In all honesty, one of my colleagues recently said, "Well, you're really getting outside the scope of music therapy," but I'm just interested in how music can play a role in a lot of different ways in terms of cancer patients, and in particular, you know, wherever they are in receiving treatment, or survivors, or at the end of life. So there are the line of publications that are related to SMART and the development of SMART, which is probably a really great model. I don't know that many models exist in our literature base that show from feasibility to RCT, and even in the mixed methods that we're doing now with those studies, with the data that hasn't been published yet. So there's that line. You know, of course, working with Sherry is always a great joy for me. And then I have some, Russell Hilliard approached me several years ago because Seasons Hospice was growing, and, you know, they have that business plan that they hire a music therapist at each site. And hospice is in itself a big black box. Nobody quite understands how it works and how it can be best utilized. And given the amount of money that the government spends on hospice care, and at the aging population, that seems to be important to find out the best way to deliver hospice so people can have good experiences at the end of life. So I was happy to help with that. And so we have the most recent publication in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, the propensity score analysis, looking at family satisfaction in terms of whether related to receiving music therapy or not. So that's provided some really interesting questions. And then, you know, in my mind, any good research study gives you three or four new questions. So it's like a tree. Sherry and I have a nursing colleague that talks about research trees and how you know, things just branch off of each other. And then every once in a while you have to prune things and kind of get it back in focus. But what I'm really interested in now and that we're working on, and what Caitlin alluded to, is this clinical decision making, which requires, you know, using the best evidence available, but it also requires some reflection in terms of the therapist, and it taps into the clinical wisdom of the therapist and how they decide what they're going to do and how they talk about why they're doing what they're doing, you know, and understanding, you know, we have such a wide range of choices, you know, for interventions, you know, and how we tailor the music to our patient preferences and needs, that it's interesting to me to look at how people are thinking about what they're doing and why they're doing that. So that's kind of the direction I'm going now. I think it has a lot of pedagogical implications, especially given some of the discussions we're having about the educational needs of music therapists. So getting it is kind of where you're going to see my publications go probably in the next several years.
I thought I had a perfectly good analogy with my constellation, and then you went and gave me a better one with your trees and the pruning and everything, because you can't prune stars out of the constellation. So now I have to go back and rethink that. But it also led me to another question for you, Sherry, which is a little bit, I want to ask you a different one now, especially in your role as editor of the Journal of Music Therapy. So Deb's talking about all these different journals that you've all published, and then she goes off sort of a different way with hospice and everything. What do you have advice, or do you have a general thought pattern as you decide yourself where you think certain publications, or where you think certain bits of research should go in terms of publications, and do you see that, and does your role as an editor inform that as you see people, you know, sending things your way, and then you're thinking about, well, what's the scope, what's the mission of JMT in particular?
Yeah. Well, I think you highlight a really important question that authors need to think about, and that's, who do I want my audience to be? So who do you feel it's most important to reach with the findings from your study? And a lot of times that's many different audiences. And how is my study consistent with the mission and the content criteria for a particular journal? And so oftentimes music therapy studies may be published in music therapy journals, but oftentimes some of them are published outside of the field or in interdisciplinary journals in an effort to increase access to music therapy research. I think one of the really exciting things is now with our partnership with Oxford University Press, we are much more visible as a journal and drawing in many more interdisciplinary readers into the journal, which is a wonderful thing. But that's really always your first question, is where I'm going to send my article. I think the other thing to keep in mind, I think it's, we always talk about our accomplishments, like, okay, so findings from SMART were published in Cancer, which is a wonderful outcome. But you have to remember too, you know, the untold study of failures is that article was submitted to another interdisciplinary, fairly high profile cancer journal, and it was immediately declined. And based on the reviewer comments, we pulled back and decided we needed to publish some more findings on Jones model before we went forward with this publication. So it wasn't until a year later that we put it out to Cancer. And even then, the comments were, it's not at a publishable quality for our journal. If you think you can address these things, we'd be happy to reconsider. But keep in mind that 50% of the people who get this kind of notification don't get published. So you just have to be persistent in moving forward. If you get declined the first time, don't stop. Keep going. And you have to take into consideration the comments that you get, because oftentimes they help you to make a much stronger article the next time around.
So, Sherry, you beautifully answered our next question. So I'm going to ask Deb and Caitlin to both answer this one. If you have any research or any advice for new researchers as they're going out and trying to look at research in music therapy.
Caitlin, do you want to start with that?
Sure. One of my current endeavors is I've been working with a colleague of mine to really talk about the importance of an evidence-based practice model in music therapy and kind of breaking down the perception that research is like on another plane, but really trying to make it accessible to clinicians and students and get people excited about what they're reading and to be able to understand and break it down. So I guess I would say you have to start somewhere. And I think that reading some of these publications is a great place to start and understanding how that pertains to your clinical practice. And then finding the gaps in your own practice knowledge that you'd like to fill, I think, is a great start coming from a clinician perspective.
So it's safe to say your advice isn't try to jump in with a pair of professionals who are already raking in NIH level grants. That you're not recommending that to new researchers?
I also, but yeah, make good friends.
Make good friends. That's good. Do a great job at your internship. Get noticed. Maybe that's yeah. some good advice too. What would you say, Deb?
I will say that, and I do this. People reach out to me occasionally. Clinicians will because their institution wants to do some research or. Even non-music therapists, all nurses contact, and I'm sure this happens to Sherry as well, and probably to you too. You know, people say, well, my institution wants to collect some data, and or we have this little intervention or this thing we do that we really like and we want to study it. And so they will contract with me, or I'll mentor somebody to help get them the information they need. So, you know, I'm always amenable to doing that if I have time to do it. And if it fits in well with what I'm currently doing, you know, if it fits in nicely as a branch of that tree. I know we're finishing up. I'm analyzing data for a hospice caregiver study that I helped some folks up in Cleveland with. And so the data we have from this pilot study is actually would be some really interesting data to do a, you know, I may take it to Russell and Seasons Hospice and say, hey, can we try this at, you know, some of the offices and see how it works in terms of caregiver stress relief and quality of life. So, you know, and I think Caitlin's right, this demystifying the research process, because really our treatment process is the same. You know, you're doing assessment, finding out what the gaps of knowledge are, you know, and then you create a plan and then you do an intervention, which would be your study, and you collect data and then you reassess, right? So the treatment planning and research process are very, very similar. And and music therapists are great at doing that. So,
So the idea that that we already have this this concept of narrowing down sort of our focus, getting our goals and objectives in line, the skills, the thinking skills at least, would you say the thinking skills of sort of assessing clients is the same as assessing what's the research problem, what are our questions, how are we going to proceed through the process? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. I think it, you know, and it makes it a little more doable, you know. You already do it every day.
Right. And then, so there's the process of research, and then there's the writing up, and then the disseminating part of research and everything too. So that's the sort of next step for people to certainly take advantage of reading the publications that you're all putting out and your research tree, like you said too. Right? Yeah.
And I want to say one more thing about writing, because, you know, I know I have a lot of publications, but I just want everybody to know that I really don't like to write that much. It's hard for me.
Well, I can edit that out. Are you sure you want to say that?
I'm really okay with saying that. And it, you know, because
it is hard. Yes, writing is hard. That's a good point.
It's hard. And sometimes I just, you know, I know people who are really meticulous and do outlines and write transition in their outlines to go from paragraph to paragraph. I'm a, you know, stream of consciousness on a page and then organizing it into an outline. And I think what's important is that you just start, you either pick up your pen or your keyboard and you start putting in information, and you just got to get something on the page. So, and I think the best lesson that I've learned in terms of writing grant proposals and papers and whatever is just you honor your own process and what seems to make sense. I know I when I get into the literature, I'm one of those people that I read an article and then I have to go, if somebody says something really interesting and has a reference after it, I have to go look at that reference. You know, so it will take me all day to read one paper because I've like gone through the whole reference section too. And I dig really deep, way deeper than I need to. And then I have to back myself way up. And I try to fight that process sometimes because I feel like I'm, you know, have these self-imposed deadlines. And it's just become easier just to honor that process, is understand how I think and how I work best. So I, you know, that's the other piece that I think that people need to realize, that it's hard. And, you know,
that might not be a bad addition to that previous question that Blythe asked, where you're talking about advice, because there's advice to the research process, but then there's advice to the writing process. I might listen to podcasts or interviews with, you know, writers of fiction or nonfiction or something, and they say the same thing. And sometimes they even say, I just hate writing. Yeah. But they just have to do the one book every year or two.
Right.
Yeah. I shouldn't say only, but that's sort of and you're right, you have to figure out what your process is and be able to go through it. It leads me to a final question for you, Sherry. Is there anything about having been an editor of the journal for the last couple of years that has changed the way that you're actually doing your own writing, in the way that you have gone through a writing process? Do you see things a little bit differently now?
Well, I think anytime you have an opportunity to be reading other people's work and editing other people's work, your own writing improves exponentially. So I think I would encourage people to not think of writing as a sole individual venture, that it's really important to, if you have co-authors, of course, you're going to be working with each other to develop the writing as you go. But if you're working independently on a manuscript, it's really important to get someone who is not immersed in the topic, who's not wedded to what's been written, because, you know, we work so hard on what we write. Sometimes it's hard to change what we've written. But bringing fresh eyes to a manuscript can bring a brand new perspective, and people see things that authors might not see themselves. I think that's the real benefit of having people proofread your work, edit your work, and the benefits of peer review. So I think the more that you're open to having other people look at and give suggestions for improving your writing, it just makes your writing that much better. So by me being having this privilege to be able to read so many different submissions on a wide range of topics, it helps me stay up to date on what's happening in the field and in the literature. And it also is helping to improve my own writing. So I would encourage others to seek out as many opportunities as you can to engage in that with other people.
So pretend we can all pretend we are the editors of Journal of Music Therapy. We're reading everyone. Well, we're all just going to do our best Sherry Robb impression, and we're going to read as much as we can. I think that's great advice. More reading equals better writing too. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Caitlin Crater, Deb Burns, and Sherry Robb for the Music Therapy Research Podcast.
Thank you.
The music for this podcast has been Cornfields of Indiana by Sonic Clams. You're listening to the podcast associated with the Music Therapy Research Blog, found at musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance.